From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 1 month ago in Rochester. Police had been called about an incident in which a man allegedly threatened his girlfriend with a gun. There are two pieces of video that have been circulating that show some of what happened next. The video begins with an officer calmly talking to a group of people on the scene. He tells the man who's recording the event that he doesn't mind if it's being captured on video. But there's tension. The tension grows. A man being questioned does not want to give his name. He's not resisting arrest. He doesn't want to give his name. Now, others at the scene begin shouting, instructing the man not to cooperate with police. The officer asks several people to stay out of the street. The man recording the video shouts at the officers. He makes racial epithets. And eventually, after police say the man refused to get out of the street, officers arrest him. Then there is screaming. A woman cries. She says, "Please don't kill him." How you view this video probably has a lot to do with how you view the national conversation on policing and community building. Some have said the police should not have arrested anyone on that scene. RPD has commended the officers on the scene for staying calm, being patient, trying to do their work. It's important to point out that this is not how every police call goes. Certainly not. But it's undeniable that there is occasionally tension. Cameras are everywhere. It can hold people accountable, but does it also make officers concerned about doing their jobs, especially if video emerges out of context? This hour, we're going to discuss policing in the age of constant video. And I want to thank Chief Michael Simonelli for coming in. He's here. Chief, nice to have you back.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Also here is Investigator Jackie Schumann. Jackie, nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And Captain Kevin Costello is here. And Captain, nice to have you as well.
Nice to be here.
Well, Chief, I want to start with that incident because it's just another recent example. Like I said, that's not every call, and thankfully not. But, you know, what does that video say to you?
Well, first, as you point out, it is not every call. We go on anywhere from 350,000 to maybe over 400,000 calls per year, which dealing with multiple people literally every year, literally millions of individual human interactions between police officers and people, and very, very, very few end up in any type of confrontation. Now, having said that, yes, that this one did end up in an arrest, but I think as you pointed out, what's unusual here is very often we just see, usually the end of the story sometimes, and we don't have video of the circumstances leading up. Now, I'm sure that frustrates police officers, and it probably frustrates the public because everybody would like to know the whole story and put it in context. In this case, although the entire incident was not videotaped, we did have two separate videotapes. One which captured much of what led up to the ultimate arrest, and then ultimately the officers moving, the second video showing the officers ultimately moving to arrest the individual who would not get out of the street and was blocking a police car from leaving.
Yeah, it was more than 6 minutes of video. A lot of the kinds of videos we tend to see about police confrontations recently have been much shorter. So this is about six total minutes. I pulled the audio from about a minute, the first minute, just so our audience can hear the way the officer was trying to interact with the people on the scene. I tried as best I could to very carefully edit out any kind of language, and I think I have got it all. But this is about the first minute, and the voice you'll hear, there's a number of voices, but primarily the two voices you'll hear is the officer, who you'll hear right away saying, "I don't mind if you're taking video," and he says, "How are you?" And the person taking the video, you'll also hear his voice as well as it begins to escalate. Let's listen.
You can videotape all you want, man.
That's
fine.
Darrell Appleberry Jr. I'm his dad. I'm his dad. Darrell Appleberry Jr.
Hi, how are you?
You his name.
All you have to do is tell me what your
name
is.
I'm his dad.
You don't have to tell you his name.
That's my He's standing dude. In the road, too.
Doesn't matter. He don't have to tell you his name.
Okay.
First of all,
that's Darrell Appleberry Jr.
Okay, if you could have spoken to us at the
first place. First of all, he has the right. He has the right to remain silent before you handcuff him.
That's right.
So, you don't know the right. What's your name? What is your name in your badge?
Record this right here. Record this right here. Record that right here.
P87.
We
got to find out what's going on. Badge number 64 here. CKSO. I don't listen to any officer.
So now
we don't. He don't need to answer.
Back up.
I don't consent to illegal
back
search
on your
porch.
Back off. Back off.
You. Go stand on your porch.
Watch who you're talking to. That's what I'm telling you.
Go stand on your porch. I don't care if you videotape me. Go stand on your porch.
I'm sovereign. Don't you get it? Look
matter.
At your face.
That doesn't mean you're
Look at your face. This is going all over.
Don't stand on your
Don't
porch.
Tell me what to do. The street is the public. Know it properly.
All right, that's about the first minute that starts to build up with tensions you hear there. And ultimately, the man who was yelling at the end there, who was taking the video, was arrested with police officers saying he would not get out of the street, blocking traffic, etc. Chief, in that case, did your officers handle it appropriately?
I believe they did. What I want to point out is, as you pointed out, the officer remained calm, was trying to engage in conversation, and what some people may not realize, what actually led to the arrest is because of the confrontation with this individual who really was not directly involved in the initial police encounter.
I think he was a neighbor.
He was a neighbor. Mm-hmm. He was not the subject. He was not, which, again, we acknowledge and we, you know, we understand people have the right to videotape. And as the officer said, we don't have a problem with people videotaping. But in this particular case, in order to de-escalate the situations, the officers decided to leave. And this individual actually stood in the street and blocked the police car from leaving. And that's the, you know, kind of the final act which led to the arrest. So to answer your question, yes, I think the officers conducted themselves properly and professionally in this case.
Okay. And so, you know, the second piece of video was hard for me to edit just because there's a lot of language. I mean, so I pulled what I could for public radio consumption. It's not hard to find the videos if you want to see it yourself. What was interesting, Chief, to me is the officer immediately said very calmly, "I don't mind if you're videotaping." Have you talked to your officers, and you know, in general, will officers respond this way? That will now say, "Hey, if you're videotaping, you're videotaping. That's
right.
Okay."
Right. Yeah, this issue evolved. I mean, people will remember that several years ago we did have an incident where an individual locally was arrested, not necessarily for videotaping the police, but certainly that impression was given. We have taken great pains to provide training. It is in our training materials. It is part of Police Academy training. We have issued training bulletins, and we have issued periodic reminders where, excuse me, what we train our officers, we try to educate the public. Videotaping is the right of most people in most situations. Where we draw the line is if there's an actual physical interference that with a police action or something that's creating a danger to the officers or a member of the community. In those cases, we do try to work with the person to move them to an area. For example, if there is an active crime scene or an active critical incident scene, people can videotape, but we try to get them in a position where they are not in danger and they're not going to endanger officers or the public. So the bottom line is, yes, we are taking great pains to educate our officers on the right of the public to videotape police operations in public.
Is that why the officer in this case was instructing people who are not involved, please get on the porch?
I think so, because, again, and it's really hard to get the full sense of the situation from the brief audio portion that you played. But, yes, what the officers are trying to do is de-escalate the situation. There was, people gathered around trying to deal with their interview of the subject that they were trying to deal with. And so the officer did ask him to get on the porch. But I think the thrust of it was get out of the street. And even then, the officers took no action to physically remove the person from the street, chose to get in their car and leave to try to de-escalate the situation.
Okay, and that was the point where the officers then stopped and arrested the man because, according to the officers, he was back in the street blocking the car.
Right. He stood in front of the police car in an apparent attempt to prevent the police car from leaving, and at that point, the officer made a judgment that it was time to make an arrest, and I stand by that judgment.
Sure. And in this case now, that arrest, the man was a resisting arrest. I believe an officer used pepper spray to help subdue?
Yes.
Okay. And there are people screaming. There's a woman crying. And she's heard saying on the video, please don't kill him. And, you know, some people might hear that and say, what are you talking about? I mean, they're not trying to kill the guy. They're trying to arrest him because he was standing in the street. But others have said they can't stop thinking about Freddie Gray, things like that. And right now, I think people have this tension. You know, police roll up and some people assume the confrontation is going to be violent. And, my guess is that makes it, you know, difficult for everybody, for the people in that neighborhood, too, and
sure,
for your officers.
No, I agree. And we know that really for a period of time now, it has been a difficult time. I do believe that, over the course of the history of our country, law enforcement has reached certain periods of time that become a crossroads for the profession. And I think we are in one of those periods now. And we deal with many, many people every day. From all backgrounds, of all races, all ethnicities, all religious backgrounds, calmly, professionally, with at least some level of trust and cooperation. But yet, it is a natural inclination of everybody to focus on those relatively few cases where that is not the case. But yes, it has an impact on the public. I think what is happening nationally has an impact on the public here on the community, and I think it also has an impact on the police officers.
So, Chief, let me ask you, and then I'll ask the other officers in the room with us here then. Are you hearing from the men and women who serve on the Rochester force? I know you've trained, you know, in most cases, you know, video, cell phone, you got to tell people that's okay. You're not going to take that away from them. But are your men and women telling you they're afraid of doing their jobs because something is going to get captured out of context and won't tell the whole story?
Well, I have heard that comment made, and, you know, I've made it clear to the department of how we're going to approach these. Number one, we are not going to rush to judgment. I'm not going to form a judgment. My job, probably the most important part of my job as chief, is to make this department accountable and as well as make sure that these officers can do their job as safely as humanly possible under the circumstances. So my approach is we will take the time. There's very often pressure for me or someone else to come out immediately and pass judgment on a video. We don't do that. We try to do it as quickly as possible when a question comes up. And the officers know that, and I think we have shown that when we look at the totality of the circumstances, all the available evidence, if what the video portrays, whether it's in context or out of context, if the officer acted properly, we're going to support them. I mean, the officers also have to know that if they engage in some type of misconduct, which happens relatively rarely in Rochester, that they will be held accountable.
Okay. Captain Costello, let me ask you, have you been concerned in recent years with the growing, you know, sort of ubiquitous cameras? Does that change your mentality as an officer?
Not for me. I work now on the body camera project, as we talked about earlier. And I listen to the officers talk about this very issue. And I think they echo what the chief just said. But in the end, they understand that any incident is a culmination of a lot of different information. A lot of people do focus on the video portion. And they do like to make sure that's put in the appropriate context. And their impressions of what happened, as well as witnesses, et cetera, would build that. And they recognize that. So when they do an investigation, they know they have to get that information, put it together. And as we move forward, we will have additional information from the body cameras from the officer's perspective. And I think they see the benefit in that, and that will provide both before and after information that is oftentimes missing in these snippet videos that we see only portions of or pieces as they come out over time.
Okay. Investigator Schumann, what do you think?
Yeah, I also echo what the chief has said. And they are looking forward to getting the body cameras, because then that will give the totality of what occurred there, you know, as opposed to the 10 seconds after the officer had initial contact with the subject, then this will give a full picture as to what happened.
Okay, and then there's a larger question that, you know, unfortunately in politics, sometimes police feel kind of dragged into the middle, and I don't want to ask any officer to make an endorsement on any particular person, et cetera. But what I do want to do is play a comment that was recently made that a lot of people were talking about from one of the leading presidential contenders. He's essentially saying in this soundbite you're about to hear that he feels the federal government has made it very difficult for police, almost intentionally so, in a political way, not supporting officers enough, making officers feel like they're unfairly scrutinized. This is Senator Ted Cruz talking to The Guardian, and I want to listen to what he says.
When the police are held out for vilification, when they're attacked, they naturally withdraw. I just chaired a hearing in the Senate in the past couple of weeks on the assault from the federal government on police and the consequence of who's paying the price, and it is the minority communities that are paying the price from the police being afraid to do their jobs. And I think that is a really unfortunate dynamic.
All right, that's Senator Ted Cruz. Chief Simonelli, again, you're not endorsing anybody. I just want you to respond to the substance of what he said. What do you think?
Well, you know, whatever perceptions people have, you know, and I'm not going to comment specifically on what the senator said. You know, police officers are human beings. What happens in their environment and in the environment around them is going to have an impact like they will on any other human beings. And I'm not really in a position to make a judgment what's going on in the rest of the country. I will say this, and I feel I can say this to anybody with no fear of contradiction, is that Rochester police officers are continuing to step up every day and do the job. We see no decrease in the proactive activity that are done to protect this community. Every day there are police officers that are putting themselves in harm's way to protect this city, taking illegal guns off the street. And, you know, I absolutely do acknowledge and I understand, and it's something as chief I have to try to figure out how to deal with, is how this impacts officers and how they're going to conduct themselves. But I will say that the professionalism of our officers is really incredible under these circumstances. You know, we've come through a period of time here where the first time in 50 years a Rochester police officer was shot and murdered in the line of duty, and that was in the midst and the continuing upheaval around the country in different departments, different cities. And through it all, this department has persevered. I don't take the credit for it. I give the credit to the men and women that are out there every day. So the bottom line is, whatever anybody's personal feelings are on this department, and I'm sure they're out there, when they come to work and put on that uniform, they're putting those feelings aside and they're putting their lives on the line every day to protect people in this city.
Well, let me let our listeners know, if you want to join the conversation on in sort of any regard, any of the different angles we're talking about this hour, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Chief Michael Simonelli is in studio with us from the Rochester Police Department, along with Investigator Jackie Schumann and Captain Kevin Costello. Isaac on Twitter writes to us about the video, about the scene and the incident that we've been referencing. He says, Chief, in that case, he says, people at that scene feared that their friend was being arbitrarily arrested, and they feared he would be harmed by the police. So Isaac is saying maybe that's why the escalation happened. What would you say to that?
Well, and that may very well be true. We understand that sometimes people are not going to agree with a loved one, a family member, a friend being arrested or being the subject of police enforcement action. What we want to emphasize, though, what the most important thing is, there is a way to question and to overturn an incorrect or an arbitrary police action. There are many avenues to do that, and that a physical or a violent confrontation on the street does no one any good. And, you know, in terms of the fear, again, this goes back to what we've been talking about, whether it's a local incident or an incident somewhere else in this country. People may have a perception or a fear, and we are trying to build trust in this community. I think that, again, this body camera program that we're embarking on is, again, a way to one of the many reasons we're doing it is to let people know that we're not afraid of the scrutiny. But the bottom line is, if people disagree with something a police officer does, a violent confrontation on the street is not the way to handle it.
Okay. Captain Costello, update us before I get to the phones. Update us where things stand on body cameras for Rochester police officers.
Sure. We're really nearing the end of our vendor selection. We're selecting a vendor to provide the service to the department. We hope to go to council within the next month to ask for permission to enter into a contract. That really starts we have our technology piece, and we will start to develop plans to install that in our offices and then train our officers in its use. As we continue to work on the development of the policy, we won't issue any cameras without a strong policy in place that deals with all the intricate details of filming videos, storing videos, etc. We are on schedule to still, by the end of this fiscal year, the end of June, to begin implementing those cameras and seeing them out in force by a sections-by-section basis. We will roll them out because of building the technology will take place, but we expect to have that in place by June of this year.
By June. And forgive me, but, you know, these conversations come up, and sometimes we just say body cameras as if they're all the same thing and they all work the same way. There are questions on, are they going to be sort of self-activated? Are they going to always be on? Will they only be on in certain scenarios? Has that been decided yet?
Well, nothing has been decided in that way yet. We've just finished five community sessions where we received input from the community. We wanted to get a feel for where the community felt we should go, because ultimately, when we develop a policy and we use things, we have to really build our policy and how we use them with a framework of reality. And one piece of that reality is, how do we use that information in a prosecution? There are rules we have to follow, and we will follow those rules. There's also rules related to release of that information to the public. Who has the right to have it? How do you get it? we need to build it within that. And then third, and we really didn't know that until the vendor selection was really near the end, get an idea of what the technology allows us to do. So we may have things we want to do now that the technology is not there, but we know we can work there. With those three pieces in place, we can really start working on that policy. We certainly have some ideas in mind. We've received a number of different pieces of information, whether we've looked at model policies, local groups have submitted them to us, and we've looked at those. The community input, our officer input, that is all part of our development of a program that really works for our community. It's one of the unique things you'll find about the body cameras. There is no one size fits all. It's really community based. What are we trying to get out of it as much as what the law requires it? Those are important pieces in developing that, and we're moving along in that direction.
Okay. Steve and Victor is first up. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm curious. It seems like a lot of the videos that I see, the people who are being videoed are trying to antagonize police officers. And what I'm wondering is, have the officers noticed a difference in behavior when there are cameras, or has the behavior always been the same? We just see it now because it's being videotaped.
I think that's a great point. I do think there have been times here where there have been attempts to antagonize police officers. I think that, the audio that you heard a little earlier in the show is an example of that. But it really you touch on really a very important fundamental point, is that, we get involved in situations that are highly emotional. They're sometimes very difficult situations for the people involved, regardless of who's right or wrong. Officers are trying to mediate conflicts, disputes. And then when the officers have to use force, even completely justified, proper use of force, it just, there's no way to make it look good or to make it look pleasant. It's kind of a gritty, ugly world that we have to operate in sometimes. When we look at it as police officers, we're almost like, we're almost like ESPN looking at, an NFL play where we're going to break it down, and we try to take the emotion out of it and look at, what the officer did, what the officer said, how the officer conducted himself, what was going on around him, the threat, how the officer dealt with that threat, were there alternatives. So we get kind of clinical when we approach this from a police perspective when we analyze these videos. But the fact is, you're raising a very important point, is that, especially as we go into body cameras, people in the general public that have not been exposed to this before are going to be seeing things in a context that they just haven't had before.
Bill in Chilai writes, does the chief have a comment about the recent video showing Chicago police gunning down a man who was holding a knife but not apparently coming after them? I know that people want you to weigh in on things in different parts of the country. That's Bill in Chilai. Chief?
I'll just say this. The officer was charged with murder. I think that speaks for itself. Honestly, I have no more information on that other than what's been released generally to the public through the media. So I don't want to make a specific comment on that, but I just think the fact that the officer's been charged, people can read into that, and it speaks for itself.
Is part of the training, part of the conversation you have with your officers, Chief, because you've talked already on this program of how much admiration you have for your men and women in this department and how highly you regard the work they're doing every day in Rochester. Is part of the conversation reminding them that a single act, even a single act of that is inappropriate, whether it rises to the level of murder or mistreatment, unfortunately tars the entire department because people start to assume that's all of you?
We start with that probably in the first 10 minutes, the first day of the police academy, and we try to emphasize that. And the fact is that most officers not only accept that, that it is part of their core belief and what they believe about themselves as Rochester police officers. Absolutely, we try to help them to understand that that what they do impacts not only the entire Rochester Police Department and the entire profession. Now, having said that, and I think there's an important point to make, we are human beings. We do make mistakes. Sometimes, looking back in hindsight, we might be able to detect alternatives that maybe something should have been done differently. So we try to be conscious of that, and through additional training, maybe policy changes, maybe different equipment, different approaches, different mindset. We try to do better. The fact is, every time we do something wrong, it is not motivated by malice, by racism, you know, or by some other horrible motive. It's sometimes we're human beings and we make mistakes, and looking back, we could have done better.
Is there anti-racism training that happens in the department?
There is quite a bit. We talk about that. We're actually looking now at some procedural justice training and some additional racism and diversity training. I think one of the things that's important to me with younger officers is many of them, well, when we hire officers now, they're typically in their 20s. They did not live through the civil rights era like I did. And, you know, some people have been around a lot longer. And to many of our newer officers of frankly, of all races, a lot of times it's just a chapter in a history book. And I think people have to understand the context, why people in the community may view what they do through the filter that they use. So, and I think it's important that our officers understand that. And understanding that is maybe the first step to better communication and better trust.
You know, it's interesting when our listeners found out, oh, you're going to be talking to the police chief and members of the department. Some people who view policing negatively say, go after them. And then some people say, you know, be fair to them. You know, they have it harder than people realize. And people want a talk show host to come down on one side or another. I always tell people, you know, I believe that when police officers do wrong, pointing it out and criticizing it is supporting police. Yep. Because it'd be like in your own company, if somebody was doing wrong, the way you support your company is you find that out, you root that out, and you make it better. So I think when police do wrong, I think it's actually a form of supporting police to point it out. But I also try not to overgeneralize and make assumptions, because you know, I think there's a lot more context to a lot of different things. I guess that's all I'm saying, Chief.
Right. And I would just follow up by saying this. Right. It's our obligation and our, you know, to make this profession a good profession, and to you know, make sure that we achieve the high standards that we aspire to achieve. When a police officer makes a mistake, does something wrong, we need to deal with it. And all we're asking is judge each officer individually on his or her own merits, the same way anybody in the public would want to be judged individually on his or her own merits.
All right, we've got a lot of questions that have come in online as well, and we're going to get to those after this short break. And if you want to call the program, you can do that. For the rest of the hour, we've got Chief Michael Simonelli and members of the Rochester Police Department talking about cameras, policing, and really sort of this new technology era that we're all in. So short break and much more with them next. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about $500 million for the Rochester Finger Lakes region. Our region was one of three upstate regions out of seven to win that state prize yesterday. So how will $500 million be spent? What kind of jobs can we expect to be created? What projects will be funded? Some of the people involved in those decisions join us in studio next hour. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Your phone calls in just a moment here. Joe writes to us on Twitter, no questions. Just want to voice my support for our officers, including the sheriffs out there and all of our officers. So that comes from Joe. And I know our officers in studio appreciate that. Jackson sends an email and says, joining late, Evan, don't know if you have any African-American officers on your show today, but I have to say, you can't deny that the African-American community feels like when officers do wrong, even if it is rare, there often isn't justice, especially when there is a black victim. That's from Jackson. So first of all, Jackson, you answer your first question. Jackie Schumann's here, African-American officer, and he's asking, he didn't know if there's any African-Americans in the studio. There is. Jackie, what do you make of his comment?
Well, I would just like to say, when I was on the street, I had it tough being a police officer and being African-American, and I was in a predominantly African-American neighborhood, and I was called so many different names because I had a job to do and I had on this uniform. So I would say that, you know, just to educate the public, it is difficult being a police officer and dealing with what we deal with, as well as when they put a label on you. I was called Uncle Tom, sellout. So those are things that became very difficult. So imagine dealing with that, putting that uniform on, and then going out and doing your job and doing the best of my ability. And so, you know, that was a difficult part.
They called you an Uncle Tom.
Yeah.
Well, do you sense in Jackson's email saying he does think the black community across this country feels like if they are involved as a victim in any case of police misconduct, there won't be justice.
And that's incorrect. Everyone is, every situation is different. And it doesn't matter what color we are. And I would say, even when you have to put on this uniform, everyone, like Chief said, we're professional in this uniform. We're not looking at what color you are, and we're not going to give you justice because you're African American. So, you know, that is not a correct statement with the Rochester Police Department.
And Chief, what would you say to concerns about justice?
Well, we understand that perception may be out there, and I agree with everything Jackie said. But I would just add that, again, we understand that people have that perception, and I think that the burden is on us, but it's also on everybody in the community to be willing to communicate, to try to understand each other, and building trust is a long evolution. And again, we have some very, very difficult history in this country, which certainly Rochester is not immune from and really is a part of, that we are dealing with. And we can't write off the history, so we have to understand that, you know, as police officers, that people may have that filter, that perception, and we have to continue to work hard, not only to bring justice to everybody, but to have people see that. And there will be times when we fall short, but overall we're committed when we fall short to fixing that and trying to do better.
Jenna writes to us, isn't it the public's responsibility to act lawfully, follow lawful orders, and be generally civil? RPD's number one job is to serve and protect. That's from Jenna. Tim in Pittsford is next. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Evan. That's the perfect segue, or lead-in, I should say, radio term. From Jenna saying there's a lack of respect there, really. I mean, when I was a kid, and I grew up in a city when I was young until about 11 in a not-so-nice area, and if I had ever spoke like that to a police officer, like the previous recording, my parents didn't hit me, but it might have changed that night, and I would have remembered that night for the rest of my life, because they do. You're supposed to teach your kids to respect police officers. They're there to serve and protect. And it doesn't seem like it's being taught in some areas now. In all honesty, the opposite is, it seems like it's being taught. And the second quick point is, some days I want to cheer for the ACLU, and other days I'm baffled. Because what do you do on a call with a body camera for something like domestic disturbance or rape? You all of a sudden show up at someone's door, the woman calls in and claims she's been raped, and now you're recording it? I tell you what, it baffles me that the ACLU would not jump in here right away and say, you guys can't have body cameras. Civil liberties, you can't have body, but yet they are completely, completely silent about this. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you, Tim. What do you think, Captain Costello, on the subject of body cameras, or maybe Chief Simonelli? Go ahead.
Well, I'll just to address the first part of the comment.
Sure.
I absolutely agree that people should be taught to respect police officers. That's their obligation. It's our obligation as police officers to deserve that respect. So it's a mutual obligation. And I'll turn the body camera question over to Captain Costello.
Yeah, go ahead, Captain.
I'd just add one thing to what the Chief said. I agree with that. But one of the things we always talk about is not paint officers with a broad brush. It's the same thing with communities. I've worked in the same communities we're talking about, and Jackie worked for me. And there were an overwhelming majority of people who respected us, stepped up for us, and treated us really well. So I wanted to make that point. That's
sure.
Important. So that is a difficult issue. I mean, the ACLU does talk about these issues, and they tend to side on making sure that this information is available for everybody to see, because we're always trying to balance this need to know in this transparency with individual rights. And really what the caller brought out is there is no easy, perfect solution to that. So there's really the approach needs to be broad-based on how you're going to do it, and then you deal with these individual specific circumstances and develop policy around those. So sexual assault victims is a perfect incident where that might be a case where you would not record, allow a victim to not be recorded, or restrict the release of that information, or when you release it to make sure the victim isn't known. That's not one way to deal with it. Those are a lot of different ways to deal with it that may still balance getting the information, ensuring things were done right, while at the same time protecting their individual rights.
Will there be, and again, if you're just joining us, Captain Costello has been talking about body cameras for Rochester Police, which should start rolling out by next June as the process moves forward. Will there be a pretty specific policy about when the release of a video would be restricted, or would that be case by case and in your, you know, essentially your call on that?
So a little bit of each. The policy will address it. It will address it in how we handle release of information, dealing with the law appropriately, the process for it. But when it comes down to individual releases in certain cases, there will be individual decisions. I'm not going to say all cases like this, never. There may be circumstances where that's appropriate, and we will have in the policy the process to follow to get there. So you have a little bit of both. You're going to deal with the issue in the policy, and then you give yourself an opportunity to bring in those differences, because no case is exactly the same as another.
Okay. Back to the phones, and this is John in Webster. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Evan. Thank you. Good conversation. I think the captain just answered quite a bit of what I was going to talk about or speak about. Things have changed considerably, you know, with the cameras everywhere. I think for the officers' protection, as well as the public, I think officers should wear a body camera for the full shift. They could be allowed to switch it off when they're in the car, unless they begin a chase or whatever, but they should switch it on as soon as they get out of the car, and they should record everything except their own bathroom trips. I think we need to have a good, solid video of their actions for their protection as well as the public. I'll take my comments offline. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Thoughts on that?
Well, like DeClar brings up a good point that whatever the policy is, there are certain things that are obvious, like things like a bathroom break mm-hmm. or other personal time that the officer has. Obviously, the camera won't be going. The when the camera will be turned on and off, and how that works, as Kevin talked about, that we've gotten a lot of external input from the community, internal input from the officers. There are going to be certain legal limitations. For example, schools, medical facilities, there may be certain categories of facilities where there may be an issue with the recording, and we're working through that now. And of course, it. Portions of this policy certainly have to be negotiated with the union, the collective bargaining agent of the police officers. So our goal is to try to make this as broad as possible, but we are frankly going to have to balance a lot of competing interests. And one of the things I've told every audience is that probably no one will be completely happy with the policy, and that includes the mayor, me, city council, the union, police officers, the public, different interest groups. We are going to try to balance these interests as carefully and thoughtfully as we can, but there is going to have to be some compromise made along the way.
All right, back to the phones and a different John in Canandaigua. This is John. Go ahead, John.
Hi, yes. I had a chance a couple years ago to do some work for a retired police officer. And he happened to fly a seaplane and also dive, a scuba diver. And I remarked that I thought that those were pretty risky kind of hobbies that he had. And his comment was is that he said, yeah, I enjoy interacting with a hostile environment in a friendly manner. And I thought that pretty well summed it up. Okay, thank you much.
Thank you, John in Canandaigua. I think I understand the point he was making there.
I may steal that line sometime. That's a good line.
let's see here. We had a question from Allison. She wants to know, has the chief ever seen an incident on camera, cell phone or otherwise, in which he did think the officer captured on camera was doing something wrong?
Nationally, yes.
Locally?
Of the one since I've been chief, a little less than 2 years. I'm trying to think back. There's maybe been, I don't know, maybe half a dozen videos here and there. Locally so far, of the snippets that I've seen on of cell phone video that have been captured, I have not seen anything yet. But again, it's a very, very, very small number, bearing in mind that really within a year, most of our police officers interacting with the public will have body cameras, and there'll be a lot more video to look at.
I saw Investigator Schuman had made some remarks that appeared in a Democrat and Chronicle article about what protocol is, and I think maybe if we can kind of go back over, is it DeBoer protocol? I'm trying to remember the terminology. Is that right?
That's right.
Street steps. And because I think a lot of people in the public, I think you heard it. If you're just joining us, we had the audio from an incident about a month ago. Often you will hear, and I'm sure officers hear, people in public say, you can't do this, or you're not allowed to do this. And it's probably helpful to hear what is the protocol in a street incident before we even get to anything approaching an arrest, the physical confrontation, violence, et cetera. Chief?
Sure. To do what's called a DeBoer stop, it's also called maybe a stop and frisk or an investigative detention. Typically, in order to actually arrest someone, to take them into custody, you need probable cause that they've committed an offense. A street stop can be made on a lesser level of proof that's referred to as reasonable suspicion. And that means there's articulable basis that the officer has, based on any number of facts and circumstances, to have a reasonable suspicion that there's some type of criminal activity going on. So we spend a lot of time trying to train our officers on what they can do, what they can't do. In these various situations, there's a very large gray area here. A lot of judgment goes in, and the officer's training, experience, the circumstances, again, many other factors will come into play. What I'd like to emphasize is, officers are allowed to go up and voluntarily engage anyone in conversation. I mean, we really encourage that, whether, you know, if they're walking or get out of their car or have occasion to see someone, that we encourage our officers to talk to people. On the other hand, if they don't have a level of reasonable suspicion to detain them, if that person wants to walk away, the person can walk away.
Okay. In Rochester, this is Ross next up. Go ahead, Ross.
Hello. Was just curious, is there going to be any system in place for, say, an officer is supposed to be recording on their body camera and they are not, and then there's some altercation that's questionable? Is there going to be a process in place to handle that, or how would it be handled?
In other words, a controversial incident and the officer turns out not to have recorded it, Ross?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Thanks for the phone call, Ross. Chief, any idea yet? Is there a protocol for that?
Well, that's part of that will have to be addressed in our policy, and that's something that we will have to negotiate with the union to try to come up with something that's mutually acceptable. But that is an important point that has been raised at all the community meetings that that we've gone to, and I know the officers are interested in how that process is going to work. So we know we have to address that in some fashion.
Okay, so that's going to be working with the union, for example.
Yes, sir.
As often is the case. But there will be, is it fair to say to Ross and people with a similar question that an officer who turns off the camera when they are not supposed to, there will be some kind of a penalty or some kind of repercussions?
Again, since that's going to be an area of negotiations, we're just not going to talk about it publicly, but we do know that that is a point that we have to deal with.
Okay. In Rochester, this is Emily. Go ahead, Emily.
Hi, this is Emily Good. And Chief Simonelli, I don't think I've ever had the chance to meet you. While your predecessor had the opportunity to personally arrest me, I had the case a few years ago of being arrested for videotaping, and you mentioned it earlier, and you said it wasn't for videotaping, and I just don't know quite what else it could have been for. But the point I want to make is that it's very hard not to paint all officers with a broad brush when the leadership of the union, Mike Nazio, has been arrested and indicted for threatening, assaulting people, using firearms inappropriately, embezzling money, and went on trial, and a jury of 11 white jurors found them not guilty, but, and I quote, one of the jurors said, it wasn't a case of us not thinking that these things never happened. It just was a lack of direct evidence. So when this man is the person who speaks for officers, who speaks with many officers standing behind him, and he is a liar, I can personally say, because he has quoted things that happened in my videotape that did not happen. You know, it's really hard to trust or respect the officers who are voting for him to be their leader. They're standing behind him. They're allowing him to speak for them. he's a criminal. All right. And,
all right. Emily, just let me jump in and say, I do want to let the chief respond. You've given us a lot there. I mean, I know you're calling him a criminal. He was, he's been acquitted, but Emily's saying she doesn't buy that. So Emily, thank you, first of all, for the call. Chief Simonelli, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I've met you several times. I'm disappointed you don't remember me, but I've never arrested you, but I have met you several times. I'm not going to address the issue. Mike Mazzeo is the president of the union, and, he doesn't, he can speak for himself, so I'm not going to try to speak for him. I will say this. I'm going to go back to what I've been trying to say since I've been chief. We have an obligation to act in a proper and a professional manner to build trust. To continue to build trust, when we do make a mistake or do something wrong, we have an obligation to deal with it. And I am sure that you or many others, or some others anyway, may think on certain occasions we don't live up to that trust. So all I'm going to say in a general way is, we recognize it is a mutual obligation that we need to, we want people to respect us, but we have to deserve that respect. And I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Emily, thank you for the phone call. And, Chief, I think in some ways this hour, we've at least worked through the fact that you're feeling, not every stop, like we said, is reflected exactly the way we opened the hour with the incident from a month ago. But there is that tension. There is that concern. What have you seen in your roughly 2 years of being the chief in terms of change? Is it more tense now because of more scrutiny with cameras? Is it more tense because of incidents we've seen around the country? Or is this community sort of in better shape with police-community relations?
Well, let me say this. I've said this a couple times already during the show that absolutely that some of the incidents, all the incidents that have happened involving law enforcement around the country have had an impact here on the community and on our officers. So, yes, the answer to the question is yes, there has been an impact. And I think that because of these incidents, there have been tensions that are we have to deal with. In the 2 years since I've been chief, it's frankly been a very eventful 2 years in a number of ways. I have seen cases where certain segments of the community seem to have a lack of trust of the police, and we're working hard to try to improve that. But again, I see the police officers going out there every day and doing their job. We've had some significant incidents here in the last 2 years, which in other communities could have resulted in many more problems. And in this case, it's been my approach and the mayor's approach to get out in front as soon as we can, get it out in front of people, and let people make their judgments. So I think as video continues, as we continue to get more videos, especially as we go to body cameras, and there's going to be many, many, many videos. I wish people could take the time to watch the thousands and thousands of hours of professional, proper police interaction. They won't make the news when we do something that's more controversial or is questioned that will make the news.
Al writes to us, and this may be time for the final listener question. Al just said, the chief has said in the past that he values having a diverse force and that it's more diverse than, for example, Ferguson, but not as diverse as it could be. How are we doing on recruiting a diversity of officers?
Well, we've been doing very well over the last several years. I can tell you that the city of Rochester is under a federal consent decree that requires us to work to achieve a 25% minority representation in the police department. We are actually above 25%. We're actually around 26% right now. The last several police academy classes we put on have been either split evenly 50-50 with minorities and non-minorities. We've had one class where actually we had a majority of minorities in the class. So we want to do better. We're going to continue to work to do better. We just got done with our recruitment season for the most recent test in November. We've already had two meetings to kind of debrief that. We are going to have more meetings, and as we go through our next recruitment cycle, we're going to try to do even better.
I'll say it again. Every time we've called the chief's office, he said, when do you want us there? And this community is going to continue to have these kinds of conversations as we go forward on these many different issues. You learned this hour how we're moving toward police body cameras, and that's going to happen late spring, early summer in Rochester. So a lot more to talk about, and I just want to thank Chief Michael Simonelli for being here, spending the hour with us, taking your phone calls, and I hope to see you again soon. Thanks, Chief.
Thank you.
And Investigator Jackie Schumann, nice to see you as well. Thank you, Investigator.
Evan. Thank you.
Captain Kevin Casella. Thanks, Captain.
Thank you for having me.
Short break, and we're talking economic development, $500 million, and where that money goes next hour.